So, as part of my job, I am in the lovely privileged position that I get to speak to a range of people every day that I guess wouldn't necessarily share different aspects because it's a confidential encounter with other people or people that they're close to. And when I speak to young people, I've had a few that have disclosed to me and insinuated that that's really where they've got all their information from.
Right.
And I commonly find that things have been really quite normalised in terms of, we always talk about like Brazilians and having all the hair gone.
Yeah.
That's a really common one that I guess from porn, and that's the vaginas and the genitals that people are used to seeing in their mind, that not having it all gone is like a really archaic, gross, unacceptable way of being.
Welcome to Sex Power Money. My name's Sarah Pascoe. This week, I'm joined by brilliant comedian Sophie Duker. Her Edinburgh show, her debut was called Venus, and touches upon a lot of the things that we're discussing in today's podcast. Also with us is Dr. Annabelle Soamimo. She's a community sexual reproductive health doctor. We're going to be talking about depictions of race in porn and the complications of race in dating. We're going to be talking about Sarah Bartram and the awful history of the speculum.
So I do think that there is, for a younger generation and people that have grown up with it, they can't really dissociate what is like, what is a normal encounter and what is...
So these people that you speak to, I guess, if because they've got all this information on the internet, they don't have other resources, as in they don't have the efficient, they don't have sufficient sex education or relationships with kind of close family members or anyone they could ask questions to.
So we're in a really interesting time, and it's a really interesting time to be talking about this, because obviously we've had the government recently develop the sex education guidelines, which they want to make mandatory. And part of that, I think, is a growing understanding that this younger generation, due to social media and widening access of the internet, are getting a lot of their information online before they actually have any comprehensive sex education.
Yeah.
And a really recent research poll said that most people are seeing pornographic images around, I think, 11 and 12.
Yes, yeah.
And then there was actually a study that was presented at a recent conference, Sexual Reproductive Health meeting I was at, and it said that some people in that school were saying the average age for them was about 7 or 8. So the information that they're accessing about sex for a lot of very young people, the first instant is porn.
I was gonna say something that we were talking about. So I know Annabelle, when we were last talking about pornography, I think Annabelle mentioned that some of the girls that came in to see her came from a specific kind of community where they wouldn't have a lot of sex education or open conversations about sex.
Just because it's a kind of a very private thing. Or you wait till people get older to talk about it.
So it's a combination. So as part of the community-based project I do, Decolonizing Contraception, we do things around access of sexual health information, predominantly for Black and brown people. And they might not get that information until much later on, because in their community it might be that it's no sex before marriage. So they just, they're kept away from that information. Or the fact that it's considered stigma or taboo, or they have two languages, and actually there's not as many words around sex and genitals used in their home. So it can be so many different reasons.
I think that's really interesting. So I think if, like, with that there's like less representation of the kind of sex that you have, if you're like a young person of colour, or say that you're a young like person who's like religiously conservative or would be considered conservative, or you're a young queer person, the way that you would find about one of the places where there is that kind of diversity is in pornography. Like, you can find, people say you can find pretty much anything in pornography. And in a film that I was watching recently, Booksmart, one of the characters is a gay woman, and she doesn't know how to, she's like, she's not been with a woman, so like her friend's like, let's watch some porn, you'll find out how to do it. And I think that's kind of what you do. Like, you don't have, you're not going to go to your teacher and be like, I think that next week at this party I might do this. You're like, no, I'll just see how it happens with.
And to be honest, like, talking from a personal perspective, I one of my first encounters like with sexual things was from pornography.
So how old were you guys? I won't ask anything too specific, but how old were you when you realised porn existed?
I mean, my brother is about 3 or 4 years older than me.
Yes.
And I think I first became aware probably like maybe like 11.
Yeah.
Because he was, you know, teenager age, and I remember him getting into trouble with my parents because they found some stuff or like, and then I, being the curious young person that I was, like looked at this.
So did you know sex existed by then, or was that all around the same kind of time?
I think it was like around like similar time-ish. I don't really, I think it was around a similar time, and I don't think my frame of reference for really like what it was particularly clear.
Sure.
I just realised it was like a bit of naughty and like, ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I knew. I think I'd heard it like referenced on things like porn, but I didn't know what it was. I used to think that like sex was just like naked hugging, which would be nice.
That's the things you try to imagine, don't you, when you've got a little bit of information.
Yeah, you're like,
my friend thought that people had to fart in each other's bums.
Oh, God.
Because if you've
Did
got a, if, you've got a, if you've got a little bit, you know that it's rude, you think, oh, that's rude, and it involves bums and whatever you think. Yeah,
I actually found a porn film that I assume belonged to my dad.
Yeah.
It was called The Art of Massage, and it was one of it was the first pornographic film I ever watched, and it was really like,
this is like on a VCR kind
of. It was on a DVD.
Okay.
I worked a lot like in Asia, and he brought back lots of like DVDs. Like discs. I don't know if they were DVDs yet, but he brought back like lots of films on disc and like a huge like packet of them. And one of them was this film, The Art of Massage, which I secretly watched.
Yeah. And then, and how did you feel about it?
It was quite like, so there was a lot of oil. There was like a whole lot of oil. People were like glistening. I think it was quite softcore.
Yeah, it sounds very softcore. It's got the word art in it. Yeah.
But there were like,
I think most of the women in it, I remember, had like massive boobs. So like a lot of them must have had implants. Mm. I think they were basically all blonde. A lot of like bronzed blonde bodies in like darkened massage parlours. I think there was one scene in the shower. And I was just like, this seems really strange.
Yeah.
With all these messages.
So it was more like a kind of a curiosity kind of thing.
I was kind of, I definitely didn't watch it to be like, this is sexy.
Yes.
But I think, I mean, I really don't think, I think now I wouldn't find it that sexy. And even then I was like, it's just there's too many weird moving parts. They're all just kind of like oiled and gyrating and there wasn't very much. Yeah. But that was the first porn film I watched. And
But I think this is really interesting. And I think we are becoming more aware that we knew this anyway, but it's becoming more acceptable to talk about that. For young people, they sometimes have these sexual urges well before kind of maybe puberty kicks in and may find porn arousing, and I think that's like a taboo that we are gradually moving away from, but I don't think people feel quite comfortable saying a 9 or 10 year old
will have sexual feelings. We're so worried about children being sexualized by adults, we just have to deny that any sexuality from children, whereas actually what it is children have their sexuality and no one's allowed to touch it or shame them. That's theirs. And that doesn't mean they want to have sex with you or anyone, but it's horrible that that's denied, because actually like I was like so incredibly curious about everything. I was so desperate to know about sex. It felt like this thing that adults were the gatekeepers of. Like they knew it all. My mum once used a sentence, a really disgusting sentence. She described something. She'd been on a works weekend and she described something as the ultimate orgasm. And I was like, what's that?
What's an orgasm?
Tell me right. Come on, I know that's a word. Come on.
Had you heard it before?
No.
No, but you just knew it was
even
like
in that context,
big
I was like,
word.
That is a sex word, yeah. And I was collecting them.
You collect
them? I was, because this before the internet.
You're like a little detective. Yeah. You've got like a scrapbook. They're like, oh.
I was disgusting. I knew what felching was, but everyone at my school did. There was this thing of like, guess, do you know this thing?
You
suck it out of a straw. And then what else is it? I kept telling people what semen tasted like. And this is 6 years before I had tasted any. But I was like, it's like washing powder with toothpaste.
And everyone was like, cool.
So wrong. I think I was like, because back then it was like all these magazines like Just 17 and things. And so you could read things and kind of, again, piece it together wrongly.
Oh.
But to go back to the topic, I guess something I found really shocking is depiction of race in porn. All these, so many stereotypes that I feel like the rest of the world we are trying to improve, mm-hmm. while there's still a long way to go and lots of problems, there's lots of discussion, and I've been really surprised there isn't more discussion about racism in pornography.
So it's really interesting that at the moment, you may have heard of the government tried to introduce controls around porn.
Oh, yeah, in this country, yeah.
Yeah, in this country, and implementing an age war.
Yes.
You have to enter your identification. And yes. A lot of that has been around the sexualisation of children, yes. and where they're getting the information from. Mm. But completely omitted from the conversation has been the other things that yes. porn teaches children, one of them being racism,
yeah,
and other forms of prejudice,
yeah,
that are deeply embedded within pornography, mm. And how that hasn't really been unpicked at all. Mm. And just from my personal stance, I think porn is something that can be really beneficial and normal, and lots of people get a lot
from. Well, lots of surveys say that. And in terms of almost what you were saying earlier, it can be an educational tool for people. Some people will find out they desire certain things or are more sexually fluid, all from watching porn. We have this idea that people watch it and suddenly become very brutalized and violent, but actually for some people it just makes them be more sexually creative and things. And so obviously that should be discussed alongside.
There are groups and things like that are making porn that is, I guess, more
yes.
equal,
yeah.
And doesn't have these things. So there are other ways of creating pornography. Mm. But yeah, I think one of the things is that if you do a quick kind of search of like the major porn sites,
yeah.
And the most freely, easily accessible porn is structured often around racial narratives.
Yes.
The descriptions on the porn
yes.
will be, big black penis or,
yes.
Petite Asian
yes.
girl,
yeah.
Submissive,
yes.
and then they'll just be, they'll also be like big busty blonde gets rammed, and
yeah.
it's all like I think most adults are fairly familiar with what pornographic
yes.
languages
and that's the truth for people who maybe don't have limbs or are very old. Everyone becomes a really ugly offensive word,
MILF or I watch porn some of the time. I'm not watching it now, but
thank you for turning it off.
Sorry, I feel like I should contribute to this conversation. So I watch porn and I've seen all the, so I watch porn and I realised for a long time that I wasn't watching people of colour in porn.
Oh, that's interesting.
So then I wasn't specifically...
It wasn't conscious,
It was just what was, available. I was I talk about this a bit in my show called Venus, which is interesting what you said a little bit earlier about how medical documents, probably from the past, or medical writing, echoes descriptions that you would see mainly in maybe in pornographic descriptions.
Yeah.
Because the Black Venus was a woman that was taken
Sarah,
from... Sarah is the cute name for her.
Okay.
The term and demon. So Sarah Bartman, she was
yes.
taken from South Africa.
Yeah.
Well, she signed a letter of consent to say that she could go, but she couldn't speak English.
So this is 19th century.
I think it's early 19th century, late 17th
yes.
century. I'm not sure quite when she arrived, but she was exhibited as an object of fascination.
So they were kind of like living museums.
Yeah.
We call them now, but actually kind of freak show.
Yeah.
And they were obsessed with her as a sexual being, weren't they? Because of the shape of her body.
Yeah. She had quite large... the pictures that depict her, really large buttocks.
Yes.
And I think other descriptions, large buttocks, drooping breasts. Mm.
But they also say stuff like she had really little ears.
And
like
fine
a monkey.
Arms.
Yeah,
this is
yeah.
the thing. Everyone who wrote about her was so obsessed with her. And the thing that's very shocking to our sensibilities, not only was this woman kind of paraded around nude for people to stare at, for white people to stare at, then when she died, they cut her up and then wrote in great detail. And her labia was then in a museum in Paris.
Yeah.
It's just, it's this weird kind of taking of the body and just ownership of the body, taking it away.
But it was
from
like with black men who had their penises or who were castrated with lynchings and this kind of thing, because there was a sexualization to the fear and the fascination.
Yeah, completely.
And I think in terms of what I do with our my organisation, Decolonising Contraception, other people of colour, and trying to discuss this and the racial element of sexual reproductive health, this is something that's been ingrained, as we see from the beginning, and it's actually, yes, it's not just coincidence. It was quite a fundamental part of colonialism.
Yes, it absolutely
that,
was.
In terms of division and saying that we are better.
As in, yeah, yes,
to make a justification, yeah, mm, why it's more acceptable to ignore the sexualization, yeah, of, yes, like young black women, yeah, and why that goes ignored and things, yeah, like that. Definitely. So it was just a fundamental part of colonialism to create this, and it links so well to other parts in terms of you had the black people and brown people being characterised as polygamous, hypersexual,
yes, yeah,
and all of that linking to savagery and being debased.
Yeah.
And then whiteness being very connected with, you know, monogamy, yeah, and purity
and innocence.
And
so if you look at like porn, like, mm, porn videos, which are interracial, and so, mm, I started watching pornography, I think partly as a way of exploring my sexuality as,
yes,
well. So I watched a lot of lesbian pornography, which is very widely watched and watched by lots of people, mm, who don't identify as queer,
yes,
women. But I started watching it, and then when it was a black girl and a white girl, the black girl would usually typically be characterised as this like super dominant, like super aggressive,
mm,
like,
yeah,
it'd be like these like black booty bitches and, mm, this like innocent white kitten, mm, and I'd be like, okay, this is like, it's weird because you like, I think to an extent you're trying to see some like sort of template for yourself or what you desire,
yes, yeah,
but even if what you desire is like not, if even if I was like, okay, so I desire this person in this video,
yes,
it's kind of,
it's only getting made because someone was getting off on it.
Yeah.
So that's the,
yeah,
thing.
I think there's also an element of things being taboo.
Yeah.
And I think there's been this from and really compounded by slavery of kind of enjoying the sexuality of black people, but,
mm,
then it being a stigmatizing and taboo thing to enjoy that sexuality. And you see that in porn, where I think this genre, part of people getting off on it is,
yeah,
the idea that it's like a kink that they shouldn't be doing.
Right.
I shouldn't find this person or this thing attractive.
Okay.
And, mm, I'm watching it and now I'm here,
yeah,
you know?
Mm.
It's like, and that's like with other kinks, you know, in terms of you shouldn't, or this is a bit,
yes,
too much or
but,
too,
yes,
far.
I think it's really interesting how kinks get distilled into like everyday or mainstream entertainment. So obviously,
yes,
like 50 Shades of Grey got loads,
yes,
of people into like very like starter pack, like BDSM.
Yes, yeah, fluffy handcuffs.
fluffy handcuffs,
yeah.
Tiny little whip, like egg beater.
Yeah.
But then like with stuff like black men in pornography, there's this show that one of my colleagues went to called The Chocolate Men.
What's that?
It's a, yeah, male strip show,
okay,
at Spearmint Rhino, where all of,
yeah,
the men are black. They're like super muscular, super...
So how is this
and
allowed?
I heard that and I was like,
yeah,
what?
Yeah.
I'm actually really happy you brought that up, because I think one of the things is, and we're talking about, I guess, also the repercussions of what it means when you have this information being disseminated,
yes,
and,
yeah,
what happens. And one of the things is that I do think some of these, as a black woman,
yeah,
and I know from speaking to my black male friends,
yes,
and my brother and things like that, some of these things then become internalized,
yes,
as well, because you have these shows.
So
where...
there's so many things that I want to ask about. So the word chocolate, isn't that already...
So that is deeply problematic,
yes,
in itself,
yeah,
and comes up again in pornography quite,
yes,
frequently. Caramel,
yes,
chocolate,
yes,
ebony,
yes,
and all of the,
yeah,
that kind of language.
And then,
yeah,
and then,
I've been called chocolate by random men. But like,
yeah,
yeah,
who think
we
think
in France,
this,
as well,
yeah,
it was like men with chocolate.
Gosh,
and I was like,
yeah, really nice.
Yeah, that's flirty.
Yeah. Like,
oh,
yeah,
gosh. And then who's in the audience of this...
So,
show.
I think...
Is it gay men?
It's not for gay men.
It's not for
women. I think... So, from the videos on the website, I think that in a way that some of it is directed towards, like, the black community in London. But when my friend went, they said that the audience was not... like that. So in the videos,
yes,
there are black women,
yes,
being like, so it's a kind of like, oh, maybe,
yes,
this is like an urban strip show.
Yes, yeah.
But I think it's, I don't think it's, it's definitely not uniquely that. It's obviously,
no,
not an exclusive event or specifically marketed as an urban event, but I think it is kind of, it's meant to be a sort of, yeah, chocolate kink.
Yeah.
And there are lots of like women who are not black, who are also other, like my friend that went,
mm,
was a South Asian woman.
Yeah.
A lot of Hindus. I think it's just like, it's, I mean, it's really problematic.
And in terms of the songs and the stuff that they dance to,
mm-hmm,
is that just like normal stripping?
I haven't seen the show.
No, you haven't seen the show. Yeah. I had to go to see the Dream Boys for my sister's Hindu. And I've just found it so interesting because, you know, and I've never been to a normal show. I've never been to Spearmint Rhino on a regular night where it's female strippers, but they have all of these bouncers and stuff because the men could actually physically, if they wanted to, hurt the women or overpower the women, whereas these strippers are like twice my size. Like, they like punch me to death. So it's basically, yeah, it's like there's this pretense of power imbalance. Like, it's people, yeah, like screaming, yeah, but yeah, no, it's no, interesting.
I,
yeah,
I think with the, I'm not a sex worker. I do speak to sex workers quite regularly with my work, and then I, yeah, do have friends that are sex workers. But I think in terms of the men that are taking part in these shows, and also the people taking part in the yes, pornography, I think, yeah, sometimes it's difficult because there'll yeah, be a range of opinions on, yes, it in terms, yeah, of how they feel about this fetishization or the language being used. But then at the same time, this is people's livelihoods, yes, and sometimes fighting against this narrative, yeah, is very draining, and also you just want to, yeah, make your living, and yes, you do maybe enjoy most of the work.
I absolutely,
and then how much you are willing to fight against that, yes, dominant narrative, or how much you even find it a problem, can be really tricky. Yes. And I've had friends say, in terms of like the dark chocolate narrative, that actually this works really well for me in terms of picking up, yes, women,
yes, yeah,
in a sexual way,
yeah,
and actually I can't be bothered to have a more detailed conversation, no, about what that means for my humanity,
yes,
actually.
And also that's the thing, isn't it, we want society to change so that we have a more equal existence, but that we can't ever blame an individual for what they choose,
yeah,
to do,
no, absolutely,
and that's what,
yeah,
I think is very interesting about sex work or the people who make certain pornography. It's like, it's never blaming them,
yeah,
if that is their decision. It's the stuff around it. I'm much more interested in the people viewing it and the effects on those people, and also why that it's kind of prevailing.
I think, as someone who's watched porn with black women in it, I think it's really damaging to my sense of self and self-worth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Generally, not all the pornography that I've seen has been that way, but, yeah, consistently seeing...
And this is kind of mainstream pornography.
Mainstream pornography, yeah, like freely available pornography, very cheap.
Yes.
Seeing that pornography and seeing black women depicted in that way
makes me
self-conscious about the way that,
yes,
I am perceived and about the way that I'm acting and that I will be seen as like predatory. I think it affects to a certain degree with queer women of colour that I know, the expectations that people have of them sexually, in a certain relationship. So they'll expect them to be dominant. They'll expect them to...
So this is an expectation of black women?
Of black...
To be sexually dominant?
To be sexually dominant, yes. And to be like sort of like hyper-sexed and to be...
Yes.
I don't know, yeah, just kind of like kind of be a certain...
I think that ties into so much stuff though, because I think there's a narrative that black women...
In general, aggressive because
like,
they're more animalistic.
You're
going to
bring some twerking to the,
yeah,
to the bedroom. You know, there's going to, yeah, be some whole sexual booty shaking striptease.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And touche, some of my sisters got it.
Yes. Yes.
Some of them, like any,
yeah,
any group of people, do not have that and,
yeah,
do not have that level of confidence. But yeah, the stereotype,
yeah,
is reinforced. And I do think that is a thing, that, you know, if you don't get that, you're going to be disappointed in some way. Because that's what people.
I guess
have signed
this,
up
is, this
for.
Is where underrepresentation in general. If a white person has had a very very limited experience with people who aren't white,
mm-hmm,
and they only experience people who aren't white in very small certain scenarios, if a white man has watched pornography with black women behaving in a certain way, like you say,
mm-hmm,
these kind of tropes, stereotypes of hypersexuality, they've made a literal connection in the way that someone who never meets black people and then watches the TV program or films where black people are always drug dealers and criminals,
mm-hmm, yeah,
the occasional judge, will also have, they will have imbibed so many messages, maybe without not even realising it, or they would never identify as racist.
No.
Yeah. And I think this happens across the board because a really other strong narrative in porn is like the submissive Asian woman.
Yes.
And that comes up really,
and
really...
non-sexual Asian men.
Actually,
that's...
there is a movement in the United States to kind of couple up more with Asian men,
yes,
and black women,
yeah,
and a movement of like more of us should date each other,
yes,
because in terms
of
the dating hierarchy,
yeah,
and how our sexuality is kind of perpetuated,
yes,
people have said, you know, actually there's lots in common there,
yeah.
and we get quite a bad deal,
yeah.
so actually you can probably relate to each other better.
Yes.
I'm not saying I necessarily agree with
no.
that, but
yeah.
it's like there's quite a lot of dating clubs and people trying to...
I was going to say that it's only recently that I've seen like Asian, like East Asian
yes.
men be like properly sexy love interest characters
yes.
on screen,
yeah.
and I feel like a lot of it has been in like quite black media. So like in Sorry to Bother You,
mm.
like one of the leads is like an East Asian man who is like sexual, and like,
yes.
and it's like East Asian men are really like are really sexy.
Yes,
but I think even in the way that they're marketed to the West, like when I was about 14, 15, loads of my friends got into K-pop,
yeah.
and there was a band called Xinhua that everyone was really into, but part of the appeal was that they were really like soft,
yes.
like soft boys, like
yeah.
really feminine, really gentle,
mm.
and they could be marketed, I guess, to a Western like
mm.
teen girl like audience who just wanted like soft, nice Aaron Carter-esque
yes.
boys. When there are so many like really big, like
yeah.
strong, but like that's not part of the brand, so they're kind of not irrelevant.
Yeah. God, I was listening to a podcast where people were talking about racial preference in dating,
mm.
and it was a woman, and her friends found this very controversial. So she was American but of East Asian descent, and she was only dating white guys, which is apparently quite a common, when they did their study, quite a common trope, and it was making a lot of American East Asian descent men very angry.
Mm.
So they were kind of Reddit threads, which there are for everything, but they're furious because they feel that they're being, I guess, ignored, and lots of them were virgins. And so this woman started, because with Tinder you can actually go, oh, I see, I'm now going to start swiping on people that I wouldn't normally. And this woman, she was then dating black guys and East Asian guys, and this in itself was kind of an unorthodox thing, because they didn't know that she had said yes to them just because of their race, not because of attraction,
oh.
to see like if she could change it.
Oh, so she was
yeah.
trying to force
yes.
herself.
She was
like...
trying to give people more of a chance to try
yeah.
and find the attraction.
Mm.
So, I mean, the whole racial dating thing is really interesting.
Mm.
I wrote a piece about this for Black Ballad, which is a website aimed at black women,
mm.
and written black by black women, because OkCupid
yes.
had some data a couple of years ago about and analysing their online dating
mm.
preferences and what was happening. It's all there, available on the internet,
okay.
And graphs and studies, and it showed overwhelmingly that black women are, you know, get the least
yes.
attention, even
yeah.
from their own from
yes.
black men,
yeah.
And you know that they're constantly kind of, even if the algorithms say they'll match, they're swiped on, they get a lot more kind of other harassment and things
yes.
like that. And they reanalyzed, I think, the data in 2 years or something, or
mm.
in 3 years, and I guess they were expecting things to have changed slightly,
yes.
but they have not improved.
Yeah.
they were surprised why,
mm.
And it's quite interesting, because I think people were kind of shocked and surprised about that data when
yes.
it was released, but I think for a lot of black women it was just like, oh
yeah,
yeah,
well,
that's just our lived
well, that's
experience.
Where the Love Island thing's mm. interesting every year, because again what you have is very little diversity, and excuse that by saying it's just a very small pool of people,
mm-hmm.
so every year you end up with one black woman and the guys don't fancy her, and then she's not in the program, she doesn't talk, she's in the background, or she's this like friend confidant character. And they don't let her leave because then they've just got a villa of quite pale people.
Yeah.
So they keep, and it's
I mean,
yeah.
I because of partly what Sophie mentioned before, that I think you have to be quite careful sometimes as a black person or any kind of person from marginalised
mm.
group about watching things that are going to trigger you, and
yes.
just how constructive that is.
Yeah.
And I was told quite early, and saw from kind of articles what Love Island was about.
Yeah.
So I chose not to dabble.
Yes.
I've dabbled a bit more this year just
for
interest.
Mm.
And I think this is one of the things that's, it perpetuates, first of all, the myth that we're not valued
yes.
in any way by
yeah.
doing that. If you put
yes.
somebody in as a tokenistic
yes.
gesture. And although we have problems maybe in terms of all the discrimination in the dating pool and that kind of
mm.
thing, there are black women getting married,
of course,
and
yeah.
getting married to a variety of people
yeah.
and living happy, healthy and fantastic lives.
Yeah.
And year on year to keep showing somebody that is rejected and upset, it then feeds into the minds of the black women watching this.
Yes.
And they internalise it, especially the younger people watching it, and think, I'm not valuable.
Yes.
And then simultaneously won't go for that person or try to put themselves forward because they're fearful of rejection. So I question what it's trying to achieve, especially by putting in such a narrow group of people.
Do you know what it is? It's when, and I say this as a white person, it's when white people make stuff and they make it diverse and think that that was the point. As in, so you have all of the people at the top in the first three levels are all white or majority white, then going, but we've, it's diverse because we put a black person in the program and that's it. That's all they have to do. So I think that's the difficulty.
And you hear all the men say, I like blonde white women.
Yes. And they knew that before they went in there.
I'm just thinking, we know that people have dating preferences shaped, as we know, by societal things that we see, like porn, like other experiences, and that is going to be fairly inevitable. So not knocking them for that. But then if they've told you what their preference is...
Yeah, you know already.
You know that that is clearly not going to work out for the other people there. So... Maybe I question whether some of these things are
intentional.
Intentional.
You think it's there's a form of entertainment going on?
In part, because if you look at some of the comments that happen around it, bearing in mind that this is a learnt thing and not just from previous episodes of Love Island, but it's something that we've seen in reality shows kind of before with how black women are portrayed and similar conversations have been had. If your job is to know this as a producer of a program, then I don't think you cannot know.
That's really interesting, isn't it? God, it's even worse than I thought. They actually know that it's going on.
I don't know. I mean, it seems to be like it's an echoing of the same storyline that happened last year.
Yes.
And I think that I'd like to think that TV producers aren't so cynical as they're like, we're going to just put her in there to just be like left on the shelf.
Yeah.
But I do think that they would think it advantages to replicate a storyline than bring in someone that might date her later on.
It's about that, isn't it?
Having that.
Oh no, this poor person. But now we've found a great person. Now we can all celebrate to be happy for them. Yeah.
But I think what's telling, I think Love Island is made for, well, it's clearly made for a heterosexual audience. Probably it's aimed mainly at like a white heterosexual audience, which is where I think a lot of porn is directed. And that's where a lot of the money in porn is gained, from catering to the interests of white heterosexual men.
Yes. Yeah.
So the lesbian pornography is not made for lesbians.
No, it's
made for men that like watching two women together. And like that just kind of drives everything that you see. Like it's not like realistic. Like if you watch, so interracial, interestingly, in porn, almost always means that there's a black person involved. It doesn't mean that like a Latina person or an Asian person, like they can have interracial scenes, but only with another black person.
Yeah.
If like there's sex happening, it's not necessarily realistic. It's going to be like very fetishistic. But even in paid for porn, so one of my friends got a subscription to something called Lust Cinema, and she gave me her login, and I went on there and I was like, okay, this is all very arty, ethical.
That's Erica Lust's website.
Erica Lust. Yeah. Like, there's lots of like really much nicer porn.
Yes. So it's really interesting because Erica Lust is one of the people on the Rashida Jones's documentary series, Hot Girls Wanted, the one she made after the film, one of which actually is very interesting, is with a male porn star talking about how much he dislikes having to perform certain roles in sex. Like this guy's, he's talking about the kind of sex he has in his real life, and then going, but at work I have to throttle them, and his notes are always to be more aggressive, and it's very interesting. But one of the episodes is with Erica Lust, and it's with someone who's having sex in pornography for the first time, and I think she was really turned on by the idea, but the logistics, the admin of like when you have to fuck for ages, it is quite painful, and you have to have a lot of lubrication, and it's really interesting to kind of see that deconstructed. But Erica Lust is a very interesting kind of pornographer, and her interest in female pleasure and the female gaze.
So I think that's something that's really in terms of thinking about the health and well-being of porn actors and actresses, that is something that is really, I think, in its infancy, and people really only just starting to talk about. I think people talked about the screening and, you know, more so using condoms and STIs and transmission and trying to make sure that they're protected in that way.
Yeah.
But thinking about like the emotional and psychological toll it takes, even that's when that's something that you've chosen to do, has been quite vastly overlooked.
Yes. Unfortunately, that's the difficulty with the idea that if you allow any kind of vulnerability or the work might be in any way taxing, well, then should anyone be doing that work if it's going to tax you so much, even though all labour has its costs?
It's labour. It is work. It's not just get to fuck someone for a nice time.
That's how people want to construct it.
I think the thing where the economics come into it so much is if people... The thing about paying for porn is that then I think, like with the arts in general, then small independent people can afford to exist and exist for people who want to watch those things. Like what I found really fascinating reading about, especially kind of feminist pornography, is that it was seen as a form of anarchism, of creating new power dynamics, of expressing how people interact in a brand new way. But you wouldn't find that on a tube site, or they get their stuff stolen so quickly that no one can produce the next film.
Yeah, like I really like some of the work from Erica Lust and other feminist pornographers, and I was like, this is better, this is great. After I'd been on Lust Cinema for a while, I was like, there are no people of colour on this site.
Oh, isn't there?
No. There are like three films that have a black woman in them, and also like I do like it, but I was like, it was kind of like the girls of porn. Like it was very appealing to a sort of like, it felt like a millennial like capitalist like fantasy. A lot of it was very arty, a lot of it looked very nice, but I was just like, there's not a huge amount of representation of the kind of people that aren't going to be buying this porn. So it's
a mirror for, like we talked before, we just said about if the market is kind of straight white men,
yeah,
it was then kind of it's like it's their tea. It's their wives, isn't it? So yeah, we're making this for their wives. Yeah,
yeah. I guess it's like it's quite hard to like, I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of gay porn. I haven't seen a lot of porn featuring like trans people. Mm. And I think to start like a pornography house or pornography company that caters specifically to that market, when there's so much shame and stigma around exploring your sexuality, you probably have to have a certain amount of privilege as a trans person to know about that kind of porn to like. Yeah. Those articles to have time to be like, oh, this is a luxury that I will afford myself. I think that would be quite hard. And I think similarly, the way that people get money at being like a person of colour in porn is by being that sort of pick me like porn actress, like being the exception that proves the rule, being that person that fits into other people's idea of kink, and then they get enough money or
also
notoriety.
It's like
to
you
be
have to say yes to some of the work, so there'll be cases I want to do this kind of stuff, but you will just also have to go, and then I just need to pay the rent this month about other jobs.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because fundamentally everything comes back down to capitalism, doesn't it?
Of course,
and the socioeconomic disparities that exist for people of colour generally. So one of my friends, she writes erotica, so she has this great website called Kaylee Daniels Dated, and it's with a black dark-skinned protagonist writing about her experiences and trying to produce that and also demonstrate that women of colour want to read erotica that features them. She knows it's true. When we talk about sexual pleasure, there are lots of women of colour that engage with it, but then it's incredibly difficult to fund a platform like that, or and I'm sure it's similar for, you know, smaller porn houses catering to those markets, because you are trying to look for money in a group of people that socioeconomically are more disadvantaged, don't have the capital, and then you're catering to this niche pool of people. So then how will things change?
It also fits into what you said earlier, because if this is also might have an overlap with a community where people aren't even being particularly well educated about sex, then it isn't just cash poor, it's also you have to be quite liberated to know my pleasure is important and I can find it wherever I want, and that's an exciting journey for me to go on. Like, you do have to be given permission for that. Like, your society has to tell you, take good care of yourself and make sure you're always keen to do things and enthusiastic, but then do what you want.
I remember I found my favourite, #favourite porn star, who was a black woman of colour. She is like a light-skinned black woman of colour, and she's very like feminine presenting. She's not like a sort of like dark-skinned black woman.
but she is Skin Diamond, who no longer does porn. And I found a porn film. So I like watched some of her porn. And the thing that I liked about her was that she wasn't always in this super like dominant, like Nubian, yes, ebony babe, like, yeah, role. She seemed to just be like a prominent porn star who would do lots of like, lots of different things, who could be hard, yes, and soft, all this stuff. I found a porn film with her in, which was a slavery porn film.
Yeah, so I'm glad you've brought this up.
That is something.
So
that
how
you could...
did you? Were you surprised to find it?
I was really surprised to find it because it kind of felt a little bit like a betrayal. It, yes, felt really demeaning. I think one thing about. I feel like one thing about performers of colour in these films is that often the sex is slightly more demeaning in some way, like they're really being brutalised, or it's like in the other way they have to do a sort of performative,
yes,
like perform, yeah, the fetish more rather than it just
it's
being neutral.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I obviously can't watch this.
Yes.
And it was just like, because she did like some really weird, she's like in her videos and when she talks about doing porn, she's like, I'm a massive nerd, I, yeah, love Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And she was in Doctor Who. She's Doctor Who. She, yes, played the, yeah, titular role of Doctor Who. Mm. And like just did weird shit that was funny. And I was like, you've got a sense of humour, like, yeah, you're a real person. I bought into her persona.
And
but
so then
I was like, how
you,
could you have...
You kind of wondered, what was that email? What was that phone call? Yeah. How did you feel on the day?
Yeah. Why did you do it? And it was, yeah. And then I have since like gone back and flashed through it because a friend of mine, since I started talking about it on stage, said that she'd watched it.
Yeah.
And I should watch it to the end. And I was like, oh, God. So I flashed through it. It's very intense BDSM porn, which I think is interesting in terms of
and
being
so
an interracial...
it's a slave and a slave owner.
Yeah, she's literally...
I mean, so that is a whole industry.
Yeah. Yes.
That is, well, not a whole industry, but a whole subsection, yes, of porn that,
yeah,
is,
yeah,
really... Well, it's not really popular, but it obviously has a following. And, yes, the videos come up online every now and again because people sometimes
people
misunderstand
who...
what they are. Or,
yeah. No, people specifically ask for it. So there was a lawsuit, yes, with a black male porn actor who was said that without his consent... A female actress was told by the director to call him the N-word without his permission.
Oh, yeah, I remember this. Yeah,
yeah. And which is just, yeah, like pretty like horrible, but like that like actresses are repeatedly asked like, oh, our viewers really like it if you, yeah, use the N-word.
Yeah.
And they're encouraged to, like, just Googling just now, I found something where it was just like a black babe like licks out her... like her racist mistress, and like the white woman is wearing like a sort of Confederate flag bikini. In the skin diamond,
yes,
film,
yeah,
at the end of it, because my friend who is a black woman or a woman of color watched it, I think she kills him and then pees on his body.
Yeah,
so it's meant to be funny. And I was like, I don't know if the fact that she kills him at the end of this incredibly,
yeah,
violent film, like, makes it better. But then I thought about, like, my relationship with some films like 12 Years a Slave.
Yes.
And this is quite intense. Like, I realise I've also spoken about this on stage. It's quite intense because I watched,
yeah,
that film and it's a really horrible, distressing film.
Yes.
I felt quite humiliated watching it. I watched it with, like, a lot of my white friends and I feel like it is torture porn.
Yes, it
it's
is.
It's one of these things where it's just like, look at this black pain.
Yes.
Look at,
yeah,
this
is
horrible stuff. I also...
But also it's a way to kind of keep... culturally repeating something that isn't without moving on the,
yeah,
discussion.
It's just like, yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's just like, oh God, like this is just so,
yeah,
awful. Also think Michael Fassbender's really hot. He plays a very bad man and a racist. But with that torture porn, I was like, this is obviously a beautifully shot piece of work. These incredibly talented actors. This is pornographic. It's for, it's entertainment. And I don't think it's aimed at necessarily the people it's depicting. And then I was like, in this weird little porn film that I don't really respect this actress for having done, she at least gets some sense of like power and autonomy at the,
yeah,
end.
And also that might have been, I mean, I'm projecting here, but when you think this, but was that what she suggested? Would she say, I'll do it if I can kill them at the,
yeah,
end?
Yeah.
Or was it that the bit that she actually thought, we're turning something completely on its head?
Yeah, I don't,
yeah,
know, but I mean, it's like, even the fact that there is more diversity, I'm not saying that it's a good thing. I personally don't think it makes,
yes,
it okay to do a slave film.
Yeah.
But I was like, she was the first female Doctor Who, to my knowledge. Skin Diamond was the first female Doctor Who. She played Doctor, huh, Who. She played, like, did all this stuff. Like, in the fact that there is a market for it and there are people watching it means that there'll be like, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's about fantasy and making things reality in porn. And part of that playing with power is how people learn to be powerful.
People characterise what porn is, I guess, differently. And when you delve into is porn art and, you know, other things like that, then some of these things are more acceptable, seem more acceptable because it's like creative license. And then is she getting some kind of, I guess you can't really call it, but maybe catharsis from like killing him at the end, because it's more of a an artistic enterprise or endeavor, however you want to kind of structure that. But then for me, I guess what it comes back down to is when you put something out into the world, and people always feel differently about this, you have a responsibility, you have like a moral responsibility of what impact that is going to have on various people, and I guess what it's trying to quote unquote achieve.
Yes.
So when it comes out to sexual pleasure and well-being, things like that, you can get that from a variety of different ways.
Yeah.
And what is the balance of something like that between causing pain and triggering a lot of people and making work that someone like I do like much more difficult, essentially. And then some people getting, I don't know, some sexual or artistic gratification out of that. And obviously, you know, people have creative license.
Do you know what you're saying? If you take the sex away, it's exactly the same as comedy, because people joke, and joking is quite often taking the opposite of what you mean, or setting up a construct. And people's defense is always, they're very clear. If you're Ricky Gervais doing a transphobic routine, well, it's very clear that I'm the idiot because I don't understand, and I think you can identify as a monkey. And then you go, well, I think everyone clapping thinks you're saying that being trans isn't a thing and you're making the world worse. And he goes, no, because that's not, I didn't mean to. And so it's very similar. People check their own intentions and go, well, if it's misinterpreted, that's not me.
If there's a market for it that completely misunderstands,
if everyone's clapping,
saying,
then I'm great, is the answer. So I wanted to talk to you more about, actually, so decolonising contraception. Yeah. So this is a project that's ongoing.
Yeah.
Yes.
What it is, it started as articles and series on Galem, which is a platform of women of colour and write and do other things. And I've been writing with them for about 4 or 5 years. And then from writing these articles around the colonial history of sexual reproductive health, which explored things such as the combined pill is characterised as this really liberating thing for white women, but actually came out of the experimentation on Puerto Rican women.
Yeah, and the speculum, all of that kind of stuff in terms of that awful man.
Yeah, so J. Marion Sims. Yes, and that's been an ongoing discussion for a while. And as we've talked about, sometimes we have these discussions and they don't really manifest in necessarily any change. So J. Marion Sims is kind of lauded as the godfather of gynecology.
Yeah, so he fistulas was what it was, is that there were women were ripping terribly, and some women obviously still do, especially young women with slim hips and in developing world. So they tear terribly when they give birth, and then were having leakage from their bladder and their colon, and causing all the kind of horrific pain and difficulties. And he is credited as the doctor who worked out how to sew people, but he did that by experimenting without anaesthesia on slave women. And they put a statue up of him, didn't they, to celebrate his great achievements.
So there's a few statues of him, and before he did his experiments, anaesthetic hadn't been invented yet, so he couldn't give them anaesthetic.
Yeah, so he wasn't being
I think the thing is that they could also not consent because they were slave women.
Yeah,
and
owned,
some people say, oh, well, you know, they wouldn't have had any medical care otherwise, so, you know, him experimenting is fine and that's their justification, but they also couldn't consent to anything.
No.
And a lot of them were pregnant because they were raped.
Yes. And also it wasn't just him and them, it was an open room of people watching.
Yeah,
like they were on slabs. It wasn't
so that's also a history of medicine that the way it was very and it was done in terms of these rooms, and people used to say it was for learning, but the patient didn't really have any consent in terms of who watched, because it was just, I guess, an experiment for learning purposes and things like that. So in terms of, it's not just the statues, actually, the speculum I pick up every day is named after him.
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of things in medicine have been renamed over the years because they were named after Nazis that discovered things through experimentation on Jewish people. And I kind of wonder why we're still left with a speculum named after this man that I think a lot of people agree his experiments were unethical. So that's one example. But the whole point of decolonizing contraception is to draw attention to things that have happened historically, but also reflect on how they still impact our practice now, and how they still have, we still have quite neo-colonial structures in place. When you look at things such as recent abortion laws in the US and Alabama, and you see what's happening there. I'm not sure if you've heard of the global gag rule. Do you know much about that?
No, please tell me.
So the global gag rule, otherwise known as the Mexico City policy, was introduced by Ronald Reagan. And it was essentially a policy that said any organisation that gets receives US funding but does work that discusses abortion at all cannot receive
won't get American funding.
So every Republican administration since Reagan has reintroduced the global gag rule. So this applies to any funding pots across globally. So often what happens is organizations that do any family planning that operate in the global south that get US funding get their funding withdrawn. And there's really good evidence, global health papers written on it, that once you take that funding away, women in the global south have often programs fail. So they have no access to contraception. There's more unplanned pregnancies. And it's a very curious thing that we seem to have still have this dependency where we have lawmakers that are predominantly white men in the US controlling the reproductive programs and freedom of women and men in the global south. And how we still are kind of happy that that is going on, and how we're really struggling to change how funding works and why we don't find these things a priority.
And also presumably working towards a point where there also isn't that structure, where things move from white men in the north and there's a dependency, because obviously that works very well for countries like America to be in that, to have that control.
And just to add on top of that, and we know, because I know a lot of people will say, like, well, these countries are really poor, so they shouldn't have all this funding from the US if they could survive on their own. But like, I think there's quite good evidence as well to that we know that actually when you tot up all the aid that the States gives, or even the UK gives, in terms of our trade deals and things like that, what we get back is actually
But also
a lot
structurally
more beneficial.
Keeping countries very poor and dependent is the other reason.
Those are conversations that we're trying to have with decolonizing contraception, but also as well as like bringing things like that more to the fore, we're trying to have discussions with younger people that live in diaspora communities about, I guess, the stigma and the taboo that they face when you are kind of managing like a dual heritage situation and when you are managing all these other, I guess, colonial effects on sexual reproductive health and what that means in practice. So we have been doing like panels and events, and we're trying to have a sexual health festival.
Oh, brilliant.
Where we talk about all like pleasure and well-being and open up those discussions a bit more. And yeah, that's,
hey,
that's
an overview. It sounds amazing. So anyone listening can find you online?
Yeah. So we have a website, www.decolonizingcontraception.com. Blog is on Galvem. And yeah, we're on Twitter and Instagram and things.
Okay. And Sophie, sounds like you're talking about all these kind of things in your shows as well.
Yes. Very, maybe too personal perspective. Do you want me to talk about myself or about the show? Or
Please both.
Okay. So I guess where I talk about this in my show is I talk a lot about skin diamond and just generally the way that black women are depicted, and about how you... as a black woman myself, you kind of like, do I need to be that way? And where do I fit in? And feeling like I had to be like kind of like the sassy best friend. I didn't imagine when like boys like imagine like their perfect partner, they would imagine anyone that looked anything like me.
Oh,
so,
really?
I just thought, I got told by someone that I think I was like sad about a boy. And my friend was like, oh, the thing about you, Sophie, is that you're niche. Oh my God. But it is, it's something that's reinforced outside of pornography, yes. obviously, I was reading an article about classic beauties across the ages who'd been given lip fillers. I think they've been given lip fillers and Botox to have like 2019 beauty standards.
Oh gosh, so what, they've taken kind of like Marilyn Monroe and
Marilyn
given
Monroe,
some cheek, okay,
Audrey Hepburn, but they had 20, like around 20 yes. classic beauty icons, but they were all white, and I was like, I have my lips are like big, like there are yes. women who do look like this, and it's not because they're like weird modern, like that. It's just because that's what they look like.
So actually, maybe this is something I could ask you both while I've got you here, because I've been reading a lot about appropriation of black women, mm-hmm. and one of those things actually that you've just said is a big full lips, or this obsession with booties.
booties,
I guess I should say.
So we love our little booties.
Yeah, I'm quite passionate about this subject as a whole.
Yeah.
I think, and if you look at some of the celebrities that we have come really to the fore in the last few years in the kind of Instagram culture, Kardashians, I suppose, they have, I guess, made certain black attributes really popular.
Yes.
But then the blackness and black skin is not popular, and people also don't want to deal with, I guess, the other stigma and discrimination and reality of blackness.
Yeah.
So I've had these discussions with my mum, not in relation to this, but just like when she was growing up, about how when she went to school as a child in primary school here, she used to be bullied quite a lot. My mum has like quite big lips. Beautiful.
Yes.
But at that time, it really wasn't cool or attractive.
Yeah.
And now, you know, my mum goes to parties and people are just like, I wish my lips were like yours. Yeah. And like how some people, I guess, try to celebrate that as a really positive change. But for me, that's not positive change, because actually the fundamental principle of how people feel about blackness and being dark-skinned black person hasn't actually changed. Yeah, people just want to take the features. And
I think when I was younger, I didn't want to, like, not like I didn't want to be black, but I didn't want to be sexualized in that way. I didn't want to like seem like I like fit into that description, because I knew if I was a sexual black woman, the only way to be a sexual black woman was to be kind of loose and to be like hypersexual, and I didn't want that. Also, one of my family members said to me that I had to be careful, because like that I didn't get like the big African butt when I grew up. So I was very self-conscious about that. Now I think it is specifically people, without meaning to, when they sexualize you or they give you compliments based on your attractiveness, they can tend to fit into those stereotypes. So a lot of the time people compliment my skin. I had a white boyfriend who had a black girlfriend before me, and someone compliments my skin and he was like, why do people always do that? People compliment my bum. I was like in the club and someone smacked me on the ass.
That's
quite
very
hard.
Common
very very and he was like, oh sorry, I couldn't help myself, it was just so juicy. And I felt like
so this, because this is the problem with dehumanizing at all stages, so when you take a bodily attribute away from a person, someone can see it and think they can hit it because it is a thing, not a
it's like
human.
It's like a meme. It's like, oh, it's a big black ass, we can have a spank on that.
So I actually did a piece that's not out yet that I went to speak to a few of my black friends about their relationships with their bottoms and how they felt about it. Because for me personally, it's been quite a kind of a key feature in terms of shaping how I feel and I think coming into my feminism. Because I had quite a mature physical appearance, I think, as a teenager. I wasn't particularly busty, but my my bottom has always been has been quite what people deem nice now, but it wasn't quite as in vogue when we were teenagers. Wasn't quite there yet.
There was, do you remember when everyone thought J-Lo had a big bottom and she's so skinny and she doesn't have a big bottom? But she was, I remember at the time, like people being like, J-Lo's ass, it's like, she doesn't have one, she's so thin.
I remember that.
And now it's like super duper. People have gone plus, plus, plus. But yeah, it for me, it really shaped how I interacted with other people, because I essentially really hated it. And then I, because people would, essentially I was, you know, 15 and I'd get people just like playing it like it's the drums at school, sometimes doing it in like a friendly way. My friends think it's friendly. I'd go to a party and it was like when Beyonce and Destiny's Child were just coming to the fore and like doing their dances and people would be like, oh, I'm sure you can shake it. And it was just such a common narrative within my like early teenage years, and I just knew instantaneously that I just didn't like it and there was something really strange about why this kept on happening to me.
And also that it feels out of your control, which I think that happens with lots of people who have an early adolescence or who have very physically developed, is like the world sees you when you don't even know who you are at the moment. Or
you can't own it when you're 14.
No, you
can't
absolutely
be like, yeah,
can't.
This is beautiful. You're just like, oh God, please don't look at me. Like, I'm really spotty and I feel uncomfortable and I don't want...
And I think... it was quite common in the groups of friends that I was with, I had at the time, because the kind of school I went to was like quite some people really quite academic and people got quite driven, but people developed eating disorders.
Yes.
And for me, I had an operation when I was 14 on my back and I lost quite a lot of weight.
Yeah.
And I just remember the utter relief that I felt because my bottom had kind of disappeared. And I really tried hard not to put that weight back on because I just felt so kind of relieved that I didn't have to deal with that additional issue and like pressure at that time. So I think people really don't appreciate how these little things can have such profound effects on people. And when I work with young people, I have to always think about these things again and remember like how vulnerable, even if they don't think they're vulnerable, and how sometimes their mind is not as fully developed, how much more susceptible they are to certain amounts of information.
The first thing that you hear on any like sexual practice, you're like, okay, that's how it's done, or that's what that means. And even if you hear stuff that conflicts it, you're like, no, someone said that this was dirty or too much, or you need to look like this.
Or you shouldn't do that or feel that and all of that stuff. Thank you so much, both of you, for talking to me. Thank you so much. It's been so interesting. And I really hope that anyone listening, this should just be the beginning of this discussion. It's so important with young people, also to go and find the resources that have been mentioned, and people can find you on Twitter.
Yeah, they can find me on Twitter. My handle is at Sophie Dukebox everywhere, and my show, I don't know when this will come out, but my show
September. End of August.
September. Find me on Twitter or Instagram at Sophie Dukebox.
Brilliant. And you already have done Edinburgh, but perhaps touring the show.
I might be touring Venus at places which you can find on the social medias.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, guys. Thank you. Thank you so much to my guests. Sophie Duker, please seek her out online and go and watch her stand-up comedy shows. She's fantastic. And thank you so much to Dr. Annabel Soamimo. Look into decolonizing contraception online and the incredible work that she's doing, and become part of it and help her out. Next week, I'll be joined by a sugar baby. Her name's Sophie Matheson. And if you don't know what that is or what it means, please tune in to find out. Thank you for listening. This has been Sex, Power, Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please recommend it to your friends. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a 5-star review so that other people can find it. Sex, Power, Money is also the name of my book that's sometimes been mentioned in the podcast. I'd love you to read it if you'd like to find out more and have your own discussions with your friends.